when you flew these missions, how many aircraft would go compared to the missions that you flew in Korea?
One.
All alone?
All alone. In Vietnam, it was almost all solo missions.
Right. When you look back now on those experiences, both in Korea, flying over Russia, flying over Vietnam and Laos, how does this play out in your mind now about what you did over there?
You know, I got to say that I enjoyed my combat tours because I was doing what I was trained to do. And I think every pilot wants to do what he's trained to do. And that's the way I look at it. I always admired those guys that were down there in the trenches looking down there and appreciated the fact that I was doing what I was doing as a pilot and not having to be down there doing what they were doing.
So after Vietnam, how did your career continue from there?
Well, after Vietnam, I came back to Shaw Air Force Base and worked in reconnaissance headquarters for a year. Then I went to Vietnam, and I ended up as a wing commander of a reconnaissance wing in, not Vietnam, in England, out of Alconbury, England, for 3.5 years, and I retired there.
And were you still flying reconnaissance missions then?
Oh, yeah. I was still flying.
And where would you fly?
Well, we would fly over northern Scotland and northern England, Scotland, Wales, and then over the continent across Denmark and France and places like that, Germany.
But not Russia?
No. No, never got close to Russia there.
So what was the attrition rate of your reconnaissance pilots?
You mean in combat?
Mm-hmm.
I was there 10 months, and we never lost a pilot.
Wow. And as you look back on your career, you just talked about how fulfilling it was. Since then, your career has been extraordinary as well. As I mentioned, about 50 years of flying safely. After you left active duty, what have you done in the flying world?
Well, not a lot. I mean, I had my own airplanes. I had a little Cassatt racer, and I built a Pitt special. I did acrobatics, and I won an acrobatic contest in Stearman once down at Galesburg, Illinois, at an international fly-in. But I think I was the only one there that learned to fly in a Stearman. So I had a little advantage.
You know, back to you mentioned in Korea about not being apprehended, but 4 or 5 years later, Gary Powers, of course, was shot down over Russia in a U-2. How is it that he was shot down flying at, 70,000 feet or something, and you guys were not apprehended when you were flying low under that?
As the difference, it was 6 years difference between the time I flew and he was shot down. And, of course, at that time, they perfected the SA-2 missile, surface-to-air missile, and that's what got him.
Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Griffin, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Did we see any pictures up there?
What? Yeah, I couldn't turn around and look, but I think they had some pictures up there. And Sam Bass, take over, Sam, would you please? Because we're going to learn about these aircraft. And, Griff, thank you very much, sir.
We're fortunate today we've got the owners of both aircraft here. The F-86 is Paul Wood, and Bill Culberson over here has the MiG-15. We'll start off with Bill here. Let's get up here and tell us a little bit about your airplane, how much thrust does it have, something about your wing, and just things of interest on it.
Sure. So as you mentioned, this is a MiG-17. In particular, it's a MiG-17F model. The F was probably the most definitive version of the MiG-17, and it was the first Soviet fighter to have an afterburner. Most people know the MiG-15 was a bit of a surprise to the Air Force in Korea, because we thought with the F-86 we had the best swept wing fighter in the world, and it turns out theirs weren't too bad either. The MiG-17 is a direct derivative of the MiG-15, with a couple of exceptions. The forward fuselage, from the fuselage break here forward, is all MiG-15. Cockpit's the same, instruments are the same, few minor changes. What they discovered on the MiG-15 is the wing is not efficient, or as efficient. And in particular, one of the problems they have, it had no aileron control under 135 knots, which is not good because you have to land sometime. So the MiG-17 was developed with a longer wing. It has what they call a kinked leading edge. Comes in at 47 degrees, comes out back out at 45, and has an additional fence. And the fence keeps airflow over the aileron, makes the airplane more like a normal airplane for landing.
Okay, what's the range of the airplane?
Range is always the best question about the MiGs. You always hear people talk about comparing the F-86 and the MiG-15, the MiG-17. And the reality is it's not a good comparison. The F-86 is a superior platform because it's aggressive, it can dogfight well, but it can also actually go somewhere. The MiGs were designed as point defense interceptors. This one will go 400 miles, but if you went into combat, it might only be 200 miles. So it's take off, hit the enemy bombers, which is all it was really designed to do. It wasn't really designed to fight other fighters, although it could. Hit the bombers, hit the targets, whatever, and get back. And in Korea, when you read the histories, you realize a lot of guys, they ran out of gas, they got excited, and by the time they got home, they're out of gas. You compare that to an F-86 pilot who flew all the way up the Korean Peninsula, went into the target with the bombers, fought off the fighters, then flew all the way back. They're different airplanes.
How about the armament on?
Armament's a very interesting design. There are two 23-millimeter cannons here, which are supposed to be the air-to-air guns. And then on the other side, it's a 37-millimeter round. Great, big, looks like a basketball from the pilots that I've talked to. The problem with the armament was good from a striking standpoint, and really was a better armament than the F-86, at least the early ones. The problem was it didn't have a very good rate of fire. The Sabre pilots I'd talked to said that many times when MiGs were shooting at them, they were actually flying through the rounds. They could see them because the rate of fire was so low. But again, the plane was designed to shoot down B-29s and that sort of thing, where the target can't maneuver very well.
Now, this is a very pristine airplane. It probably didn't look that good when it was in Korea.
This one actually isn't too bent up. This one actually looks pretty close to it. When I had it restored and painted, I asked them to not polish it up too much and make it too pretty. I wanted it to look so you could see the rivet lines and stuff. You know, the MiG is a different... The Russians have a different approach. They won their side of World War II by attrition, a lot like we did in World War II. Mm-hmm. But unlike the U.S. Air Force, which focused on technological dominance, they stuck with the idea that we're not going to try to build a very expensive, complicated airplane. We're going to build a simple, easy to fly, easy to maintain airplane, and make lots of them. And that was their mission.
Okay, last thing about the airplane. Tell us about the fuel tank problem they had to start off with.
Fuel tank problem, everybody ran into that. These fuel tanks are pretty interesting. This particular, there's two types of fuel tanks. There is the aluminum tanks, and then this is a press board tank. So it's a paper tank. And it's literally put in a mold with glue and formed up. And when they've, just like the T-33 had the same problem, or the F-80, because it uses bleed air to push fuel out of the tank and into the wing and into the engine, if you pulled the throttle back too fast, all that vacuum would go away in a high-speed descent, and the tank would collapse, and especially the press port tank. And then it'd break off right here and turn into a great big speedboard, or it'd just rip off the wing. Not
so
good.
Did they lose the airplanes most of the time or not?
Most of the time they came off clean. I do know they lost a few. Again, the it's a very rugged, I almost think of it like a farm tractor.
Well, how is it to fly?
More than an airplane. It's actually a sweetheart to fly. I've never flown an F-86, so I don't have a fair comparison, but most people that have flown both say that while they're both great flying airplanes, that the 17 is probably a little sweeter because it's not as heavy. It doesn't have all the fuel and all the fuel tanks and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bill. Bill's from Mobile Alabama, and he's one of the designees on the airplane. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you bringing the airplane here. And this is Paul Wood. He's from right down the road a little bit. And we just talked to him the other day. He's got a number of beautiful airplanes. Tell us a little bit about your F-86.
Well, this is a North American F-86F, built in 1952. And It was the U.S. Air Force's first swept-wing fighter during the Korean War. Prior to this, they had the F-80s, which were straight-wing. And I think America was a little bit surprised when they saw the MiG-15s with the swept wings. And we had the F-86 under development since about 1947. But when the MiG-15s came out, we accelerated that development and deployed these all to Korea. And that really changed the air war in Korea. Because the F-86 and the MiG-15, while they were fairly comparable airplanes, there were a lot of operational issues that allowed the F-86 to get a very superior kill ratio during the war.
Well, now you look at this little sleek airplane with this swept wing on it. My understanding was that when they first designed this, it was a straight wing airplane. It wasn't a swept wing. Is that correct?
The very, very early design concepts had a straight wing. And after the end of World War II, we had captured a lot of German data, and they had been experimenting with swept wing concepts. And we realized that that would make a big difference in terms of high-speed flight when you get close to the speed of sound, compressibility issues, and things like that. So they very quickly abandoned the straight-wing concept and went to a swept-wing concept and made all the difference in the world in terms of speed of the airplane.
Okay, last and not least, of course, how does it fly?
It is an absolute dream to fly. I love flying this airplane. It's extremely stable in cruise. It has a great wing, so it swoops very well and does loops and aerobatics very well. But it's extremely stable. So if you set it up in cruise and you're going to an air show or you're flying, on a mission, you get it all trimmed up, and it's almost like you have it on autopilot. You just sit there and you just hardly have to touch it, the controls at all. It just very, very smooth, and has great power. Once you get going, it doesn't fly real well on takeoff. It's a little bit slow transition, but once you get up to speed, 250 knots or more, it's a beautiful airplane to fly.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for bringing all your airplanes here.
My pleasure.
It's a